The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Given the full room of the audience, we're going to get started. We have two of our three expected speakers, and one is not going to be able to make it at all. And the third might show up, if we're lucky. And we're going to start off with Kelly Gowell. How do you say your last name?
Just like that.
Excellent. Who's at the New School speaking on Marxist Feminist Critical Method. And the speakers will have 20 minutes each. If I'm inspired, I might ask a discussing question or two. And then we will open it up to this impressive range of brilliant people here to respond. Please.
Thanks, Michelle. All right. My talk centers on Marxist Feminist Critical Method because I believe our historical moment requires a deepening and elaboration of both the object and horizon of radical critique, and that Marxist feminism is a vital and necessary position for doing so. I locate my discussion in the lineage of theory and practice on the terrain of social reproduction because I believe that the dire conditions of capitalist reproduction require us to broaden and deepen our understandings of struggle and political possibility. However, my claim is that grounding analysis and practice in the conditions of social reproduction also requires methodological innovation capable of radically interrogating and revisioning current practices, forms of knowledge, and affective and social capacities. I thus argue that revolutionary feminist practice adequate to our moment must elaborate and revise Marxist categories and critical analysis, and indeed those of prior feminist theories of social reproduction. I defend this claim by recalling the emancipatory orientation of critical practice shared by Marx and early theorists of domestic labor. For Marx, value is an essentially critical category insofar as it points to the internal limits of capitalist production and thus the practical possibilities that imbue it. Likewise, for Lata Feminista, the concept of domestic labor provided a unitary critique of class exploitation and gender domination by accounting for their necessary relation under capitalism, thus forming a crucial hinge without which, according to their analysis, the understanding of and struggle against capitalism was impossible. What is radical in both approaches is their ability to utilize the categories and practices at their disposal, value and domestic labor respectively, to delimit and historicize the structuring dynamics of capitalism and patriarchy, and in doing so, offer forms of liberatory practice adequate to these conditions. Marx's critique of the capitalist mode of production is grounded in the materialist supposition that social conditions shape the parameters of knowledge and practice. His critical method is accordingly conditioned by two internally connected yet irreducible historical needs, describing the structuring logic of an internal complexity of the capitalist mode of production on the one hand, and articulating the fundamental political antagonism it produces on the other. This means that Marx's aspiration to reflexively analyze the categories of bourgeois economic thought is equally and irreducibly a demand for a practical repositioning of political subjects relative to the conditions of capitalist production. This double move is what distinguishes Marxism as a critical theory. In order to connect these empirical, practical, and epistemic dimensions of critique, Marx must utilize the categories that are the result of capitalist relations while referring these categories to their historical conditions. For Marx, concepts such as value, labor, and the like are social forms which result from and express capitalist relations of production. Understood as such, they can potentially illuminate the internal dynamics and antagonisms essential to these social relations, including the connection between structures of knowledge and experience and the systemic process of exploitation essential to the capitalist mode of production. The concept of value, arguably the most pivotal of these concepts, thus not only allows us to understand the systemic exploitation and dispossession essential to the wage relation under capitalism, but also reveals classless society to be the condition of overcoming this immiseration. value is both a descriptive and also an essentially political category insofar as it describes the movement of capital as a whole and in its specificity, and also points to the internal limits of capitalist production and thus the political possibility of its destruction. In this way, it allows for insight into the social limitations that beset revolutionary practice, as well as the practical possibilities that imbue it. Social reproduction as a political and theoretical concern has its roots in this Marxist understanding of critique, but is also a self-conscious attempt to deepen and indeed radicalize it according to the demands of militant feminist organizing. Early proponents of wages for housework, for example, viewed their work as a response to the parallel inadequacies of traditional Marxism and radical feminism to account for the constitutive relation between gendered oppression and capitalist exploitation. In opposition to these positions, they elaborated a critical stance on domestic labor as the practice that connected sexual domination and exploitation dictated by capitalist accumulation. On their account, unwaged housework performed by proletarian women was labor necessary for the waged workers' daily and generational reproduction. Insofar as this labor circumscribed an entire regime of social and economic exclusion and domination upon which capitalist exploitation depended, it formed not only the necessary condition of capitalist production, but also of a historical articulation of gendered violence corresponding to it. The proponents of wages for housework claimed that insofar as domestic labor is viewed as merely a use value external to the capitalist class relation, we cannot fully understand capitalist class relations nor aim at their abolition. They claimed that the concept of domestic labor thus provided a necessary supplement to Marx's critique of political economy, as well as the feminist critique of patriarchy, by showing that they were rooted in a shared set of social conditions. As with Marx's concepts, domestic labor thus provided not only a descriptive, but also a political perspective on both wage exploitation and gender oppression, and the political demand for a wage was intended as a subversive stance against both. This understanding of the central role that domestic labor played in both capitalist production and gendered oppression allowed feminists to radicalize the critique of capitalism as well as patriarchy. Their analysis of the material and social conditions of capitalist production and gender oppression under this historical configuration also allowed feminists to elaborate a more determinate and radical political project. Expanding upon and deepening Marx's critique of value in the wage relation, their understanding of domestic labor opened a critical perspective onto not only the material and social, but also the corporeal, affective, and sexual dimensions of social relations under capitalism. The recent resurgence of theory and practice oriented towards social reproduction moves beyond this early stance, which often inadvertently reduced reproduction to the dynamics of capitalist production. That's arguable, you know. Many have claimed that in privileging the unwaged reproductive labor of the housewife as the essential condition of capitalist production, the proponents of wages for housework fail to account, for example, for the paid labor of immigrants and black women in the U.S., or the unpaid labor of slaves and native populations here and abroad, all of which are equally conditions upon which capitalist reproduction rests. To mitigate these shortcomings, recent discussions and struggles on the terrain of social reproduction are explicitly orienting their analysis and practice to the role that race, sexuality, and migration play in reproducing daily life and social relations under capitalism. This work on social reproduction renders explicit the depth of the critique of both capitalist exploitation and oppression that was arguably implicit in earlier formulations. The claim that I want to make, however, is that proponents of this return to social reproduction as a theoretical and practical ground have not self-consciously elaborated the role that method played in prior theories. This leaves the crucial problem of how to orient our understanding and struggles to the conditions of social reproduction underdetermined. To illustrate this point, I will briefly discuss the terms of the debate regarding a unitary theory of capitalist accumulation and social oppression raised in the recent Viewpoint dossier on Cinzia Rutza's On Gender. And I should note is that I work with Cinzia and I love her, and like this is a very friendly sort of amendment. for the record. Arruta's remarks on gender defends a unified theory grounded in what she terms an expanded conception of social reproduction. Social reproduction, by her definition, describes the relations of care and material sustenance, as well as the institutional and social structures in which these practices are embedded, which sustain the social organization of society on a micro and macro level. In this sense, it gives an account of capitalist relations as an articulated, moving social totality rather than merely a mode of production. Arruta argues that orienting our theory and practice of social reproduction in this expanded sense will allow Marxist feminism to move beyond the determinism, functionalism, and reductionism associated with former unitary theories, as well as the arbitrary divisions and conflations involved in theories of indifferent capitalism and dual or multiple systems. In opposition to both historical tendencies, she claims that the relation between oppression and class is non-contingently conditioned by history. As she states, quote, "The way social reproduction functions within a given social formation has an intrinsic relation to the way the production and reproduction of societies are organized in their totality, and therefore to class relations. Once again, these relations cannot be conceived as purely accidental and contingent intersections. Viewing them through the lens of social reproduction allows us to identify the organizing logic of these intersections without, for this reason, excluding the role played by struggle and the existence of contingent phenomena and practices in general." Arruta's piece played a pivotal role in on her own terms, quote, end quote. I didn't end the quote before. Arruta's piece played a pivotal role in, on her own terms, quote, "reopening the crucial debate about how we should conceptualize the structural relationship between gender oppression and capitalism." However, end quote. However, I want to claim that locating the debate in terms of the historical legacy of, again, in Arruta's terms, the logical versus historical dimensions of this relation limits the depth and scope of the Marxist-feminist project she outlines. Despite many common commitments, the contributors to the dossier also largely limit their analysis to the level of abstraction at which we can know and explain the relation between capitalist accumulation and social oppression. And thus, whether this relation is historically contingent or internal to the abstract logic of capital itself. While they disagree about these questions of logic and necessity, Ferris and Oxala both claim that a renewed Marxist feminism needs to include the theoretical advances of the intervening period between the present and the neoliberal eclipse of prior Marxist feminist thought. Ferris, for her part, claims that we should center our analysis on the dialectical relationship between the logical and historical dimensions of this relation, a task she contests will benefit from theorizing intersectionality and the organizing logic of the nation state. Oxala, on the other hand, uses a post-structuralist lens in claiming that the historical contingency, not the organizing logic, that Marxist feminist theory needs to address. Manning, for her part, claims that we should not rule out the possibility that social domination and capitalist accumulation are internally and essentially related on a logical rather than a historically contingent level. At the very least, she contends, such a unifying analysis at a high level of abstraction will lead to a more rigorous understanding of capital, race, and gender, and a corresponding practical position. In clarifying her position in response to these interlocutors, Arruta argues for a theoretical framework that appreciates the complexity and contingency of concrete struggle while bringing into relief the necessary relation between accumulation and oppression under capitalism. However, despite the promise of her title to outline, quote, "the political stakes of Marxist feminist theory," she, like Manning, does not ultimately address what these stakes are, or fully address, are, or how we are to relate our analysis to them. While she contends that we cannot draw practical mandates from the abstractions of theoretical analysis, the positive political takeaway of theorizing the internal relation between gendered and racialized domination and the organization of capitalism remains unclear. This indeterminacy is arguably due to the scope and terms of the debate, which I argue cannot fully comprehend the conditions of capitalist social reproduction or its overcoming. Not that this piece does fully comprehend that, by the way, this is because presenting the scope of Marxist feminist theorizing in terms of logic, history, and the level of abstraction at which we can locate our analysis does not adequately pose the question of how to locate our practice and analysis in our material and social conditions and limits, nor what doing so requires of our forms of struggle, knowledge, and praxis. To restate my thesis, my claim is that this question of method is of essential importance to articulating a Marxist feminist praxis and political horizon. The question is thus not simply one of theory or even practice, but how to determine the conditions and possibilities of struggle and emancipation. In the words of Silvia Federici, wages for housework was not, quote, one demand among others, but a political perspective that opened a new ground, and I should add a new horizon as well, like those are internally related, of struggle, end quote. My claim is that a Marxist feminism capable of comprehending and opposing our social conditions requires such a shift in the perspective and ground of struggle. My final remarks will explore some of the possibilities and consequences of doing so in relation to capitalist social reproduction in the present. Marxist feminism must turn its analysis to social relations themselves and theorize from the demands that they place upon us. Doing so on the terrain of social reproduction requires deep revision of both our theory and practice. Theoretically, it will be helpful to recall that a definition of reproduction and its social causality does as much or as little as a definition of capitalist production. It specifies the parameters of what we can understand and oppose ourselves to. However, we still need to do the work of acquiring new and revising old concepts and forms of knowing in order to address its concrete realities. Politically, a critique of social reproduction will have to bring the alternative modalities of struggle arising from and in opposition to capitalist social reproduction into relief, asking what a feminist, anti-racist, and anti-capitalist militancy requires of our practices and relations. The perspective of social reproduction requires us to deepen our understanding of both our social conditions and our struggles against them. It requires us to inquire into the conditions of all our relations, from the affective regimes that construct our desires to the social bonds that condition the possibility or impossibility of our survival. It requires us to revalue as political the sites of our reproduction and the reproduction of our struggles. And it requires new forms of collective practice, but also that we politically reconstitute the feminized and racialized practices of care, of harboring, of collective solidarity, and affective response that have been rendered invisible by our own political formations, yet which have kept these struggles alive. Knowledge and practice grounded in social reproduction reveals an expanded depth and scope of resistance. However, it also must contend with the severity of the damage that has been done. Orienting our analysis and practice to social reproduction means contending with the depth and complexity of historical collective traumas and their tendency to reproduce themselves. This arguably is and has been one of the most difficult aspects of emancipatory transformation. And Dalla Costa's term, subverting capital, necessarily means subverting the community itself, insofar as it is a primary site of domination and coercion. It also means collectivizing and politicizing those aspects of community, of healing and care, that are and have historically been sites of resistance and resilience. Rendering these sites of struggle explicit and elaborating our practice and theory from there. I am calling for a return to method in the radical sense that Marx and the early theorists of social reproduction intended. I claim that doing so in relation to the conditions of capitalist social reproduction requires us to radicalize our analysis and practice, refusing finally both the dogmatic and insane understanding that struggling against oppression, and thus struggling for our psychic, emotional, and material survival itself, is somehow not political, as well as the liberal assumption that we can aim at anything less than the abolition of the social forms of capital. Thanks.
Wonderful. Next up, we have Drusilla Cornell, a professor at Rutgers University and the University of Victoria in comparative literature and women's studies. And take it away.
My paper is very different. I guess I would say what connects them is that you're dealing with a struggle concept, which is for housework, and I'm dealing with a struggle concept of how to re-articulate the right to abortion and reproductive rights at a time when, as we know, Planned Parenthood has now been effectively defunded by the federal government. It's called The Fragility of the Person and the Need for the Imaginary Domain. In my talk today, I want to argue that embodied human beings demand many forms of so-called public support in order to engage in the project that I have called becoming a person. Privacy, both in Anglo-European philosophy and in the jurisprudence of the United States Supreme Court, has always turned on the notion of the individual as a given and the legal person as an expression of this idea, the self-contained subject inextricably tied to private property and literal spaces of retreat. Feminism is not anti-privacy in any simple sense. Instead, a feminist rethinking of what is of value in privacy demands that the entire discourse of the private and the public be entirely rethought, particularly because of the fragility of our lives as embodied human beings. In 1995, a text called The Imaginary Domain, I argued that we need an entirely new political and ethical rhetoric to adequately defend crucial rights for which feminists have fought. Today, I'm going to focus on the right to abortion, but it's only one of many examples. Obviously, the right to health care, the right to education, the right to a home, all of these so-called affirmative rights, none of which we have, would also apply. I argue in that text, and I still hold to this position, that the imaginary domain is the moral, legal, and ethical space that embodied and sexual human beings need in order to play out their different personas. This domain enables us to be the source of our imaginary and narratives of how we have embodied ourselves as sexuate beings who inevitably see themselves through an unconscious imago, which can endlessly be played with, re-performed, and ultimately re-narrated in the infinite project of becoming a person. Key to this argument is the idea that the person is not a given, but one that is a project which we pursue throughout our lives. This project demands at least three minimum conditions of individuation. They are as follows: bodily integrity, 2, access to symbolic forms sufficient to achieve linguistic skills, permitting the differentiation of oneself from others, and the protection of the imaginary domain itself. These minimum conditions of individuation could turn us to a much more profound understanding of trans individuality as it's been particularly embodied in African philosophy, and I would argue African socialism. Unfortunately, it's beyond my brief remarks today to discuss trans individuality, but I hope we will return to it in the discussion. For now, I want to continue my discussion of the way I use the word person. A person is what shines through a mask, even though the concept of the mask is the usual association made with the word persona, which in Latin means literally shine through. For a person to be able to shine through, she must be able to imagine herself as a whole, even if she knows that she can never truly succeed in becoming a whole person, or indeed succeed at differentiating between the mask and the self. The equal worth of each one of us demands, as a matter of legal equality, the equivalent basis for the chance to transform ourselves into the individuated beings we think of as persons. The project of the imaginary domain is to synchronize the values of equality and freedom, and in a certain sense, to think what is of value in the legal notion of privacy. That the personal is political, a famous saying in the second wave of feminism, of course, in no way is part of anti-privacy movement. Rather, it's deeply rooted in a long history of how erotic transformation challenges heteronormativity and to a vicious misogynist rejection of the feminine, which must always be part of radical transformation. Excuse me, I think I'm going to sneeze. I have spring allergy. Sorry, guys. Stephen Seeley and I have made an extended argument about erotic transformation as is integral to any meaningful revolution. And I just want to take a moment here. I've been a Marxist activist all my life, and when I was a kid, I was in many Marxist-Leninist groups. And one of my groups, Stephen Seeley and I, began this book called The Spirit of Revolution with an earlier article, which we gave at this conference 4 years ago, There's Nothing Revolutionary About a Blowjob. And the inspiration for this was in my Marxist-Leninist group, which had third world leadership. I was ordered to give a blowjob as part of socialist transformation. And I didn't see the connection between the command of the blowjob and socialism. I was very young. So I wrote a paper called True Love and the Transition to Socialism. And I hope I'll come back to that, because Marxist feminism really got to pay attention to the absolute need, from Kollontai to Rosa Luxemburg to all the great feminists, to erotic transformation. Yeah. We are not going to go into revolution. It's not just wages for housework. You know, I followed this up with a shorter piece called If Only Men Were Like Dogs. living with many dogs and having gone through many men. The imaginary domain, as a legal right, of course, would only be one aspect of such sweeping erotic transformation. But it does, as I will now argue, allow us to defend the right to abortion on the basis of equality. Justice Blackmun, in his original decision in Roe v. Wade, found he faced a dilemma. He could not defend the right to abortion on the basis of privacy. And why was that the case? Because most of our decisions are being the United States Supreme Court, when we had one, have defined privacy as a right to have space in which the state has no business interfering. Equality was also not possible for Blackmun, because equality under our jurisprudence turned on comparisons between men and women, and pregnancy was a real difference. And all the attempts to find an equivalent condition in men, such as heart attack or prostate cancer, seemed to falter or be outright ridiculous. To quote Justice Blackmun, the pregnant woman cannot be isolated in her privacy. She carries an embryo and later a fetus, if one accepts the medical definitions of the developing young in the human uterus. The situation, therefore, is entirely different from marital intimacy or bedroom possession, obscene material, or marriage, or procreation, or education, which Einstein and Griswold, Stanley, Loving, Skinner, and Pierce and Meyer were respectively concerned. Blackmun has been criticized by the left and the right, and indeed the middle, for the incoherence of his decision. But he did not have the jurisprudential resources to defend the right to abortion. And let me emphasize to, because our Supreme Court, and indeed our Constitution, has not been comfortable with imposing positive obligations on the part of the state. In the first trimester, the public nature of abortion led the court to include the doctor in the process of a decision. The second trimester, Blackmun realized that women might need more extensive medical care. What is often forgotten in Blackmun's judgment is that the second trimester begins before viability, when the baby can supposedly live outside the mother's body. His primary concern was to provide effective health care for second trimester abortions. It's only in the third trimester that the state could weigh in the interest of the fetus against the right of the mother. Since fetuses are not persons under our constitutional jurisprudence, they do not have rights. The series of judgments following Roe, Webster, Casey, amongst many others now, the court allowed states to enjoin the public facilities and employees from providing abortion. They did so on the basis that such restriction did not infringe on the women's right to choose, quote unquote. In the case of Casey, further restrictions were placed on how and under what conditions women could even get first trimester abortion. The language of choice, of course, is completely inadequate, because if a woman is terminating an unwanted pregnancy, she obviously didn't choose to get pregnant. Our bodies are not our own, and to avoid the horror of abortion done illegally in terrifying isolated conditions with medical equipment such as coat hangers, Black maneuvered he had to provide women with actual material support in order for them to have safe abortions. The right to have an abortion obviously goes way beyond the notion of choice. And yet the critics are right that Blackman's judgment falters into incoherence despite its creativity, precisely because privacy and gender equality jurisprudence could not give an adequate account of the right to abortion. But I would argue that equal protection, to use legal language, of minimum conditions of individuation would allow the right to abortion to be justified as a matter of equality. To do so, we have to understand exactly why the body, from the very beginning, needs to be able to project itself as a whole, even when that who is indeed imaginary. In the text, The Imaginary Domain, I relied on Jacques Lacan to argue that the infant needs the mirroring of others in order to see himself or herself as whole. The projection of bodily integration is necessary to avoid psychosis, and as Lacan always tells us, the ego in the imaginary is a bodily ego. From the beginning, then, for projected wholeness, the infant is dependent on others, not only through the mirroring process that the infant comes to have an imagined bodily coherence, and yes, it is imagined, which is why we need the space of the imaginary domain. The body's coherence depends on the future anteriority of the projection, in that what is yet to be imagined is already given. The infant then does not recognize a self that's already there in the mirror. Instead, the self is constituted in and through the mirroring process as other to its reality of bodily disorganization, and does this by having itself mirrored by others as a whole. The Lacanian account allows us to understand just how fragile the achievement of individuation is and why we so desperately need the protection of minimum conditions of individuation. The denial of the right to abortion should be understood as a serious symbolic assault on women's sense of self, precisely because it thwarts the projection of bodily integration and places a woman's body in the hands of the imagination of others. They would deny her coherence by separating her womb from herself. It's not an exaggeration, then, to say that the denial of the right to abortion can be understood as symbolic dismemberment of women's bodies. It's only in the worst kind of masculine fantasy that wombs wander. The wrong, as I have described it, begins long before any woman is actually pregnant, as our bodies are taken away from our own imagined projection of the meaning of our sexual being. And many of you are too young to remember the time when we didn't have the right to abortion. But I grew up with it. We also didn't have sex education, something that we're moving back to. So my best friend Annie, I mean, pregnancy was just something out there that was really scary that could happen to you. We were at dancing school, and she refused to dance with any boys because she heard they sprayed something, and that made you pregnant. My grandmother was a great believer in giving me books about facts. So I understood that men sprayed something, but the dancing wasn't necessarily the condition of the spraying, so that she could feel perfectly free to dance, but she wasn't convinced. You know, I had to read a lot of books from the library to convince her that babies didn't happen through dancing. But we grew up with this terrible fear, you know, Susie would disappear her senior year of high school because she got pregnant, you know. And of course, wealthy people had ways of getting around it. But it was a way of losing complete sense of who you were as a woman, right? And of course, the relationship to sex and masculinity was utterly terrifying. They were these spraying creatures that if you got too close to them, you might end up in a really bad way. So you better not to dance. So what I'm suggesting here is that even if you never got pregnant and needed an abortion, if you don't have the right to abortion, you live in a whole different symbolic and social world than one where you have it. Pregnancy is not like prostate cancer or heart attacks. It's a unique condition, but if we are to equally protect minimum conditions of individuation, then we can justify the right to abortion and all the facilities needed to support it on the basis of equality. The right too always demands that we recognize the public nature of the support we need, even if we are quote unquote healthy, to have our imaginary domain protected, so that our sexual being, other forms of primary identification, are ours to narrate, not the state's. This is also a basic matter of freedom, because in the case of abortion, that women are given the freedom of imagination to narrate the meaning of our own experience. Some feminists had difficulties with any woman who said they regretted their abortion or found it a tragic experience. In order to defend the right to choose, it seems that abortion has to be labeled a fairly trivial matter. But under the imaginary domain and bodily integrity, it's a woman who, as part of her right, has the ability to narrate her own imagined projection of the meaning of her bodily experience. I agree with Justice O'Connor that viability has become a very incongruent standard to when the state's interest in the fetus could trump the woman's right as defended in Roe v. Wade. My response is there's only one coherent standard. I still hold to this position today, and that is to recognize the right of abortion all the way through the cutting of the umbilical cord, and then the baby is truly outside the woman's body. And what is the limit on the imaginary domain? It's what I have called the degradation prohibition. Given the importance of freedom to play with and indeed to act out the persona of lived sexuality, I have tailored the degradation prohibition as narrowly as possible. Someone is degraded when they are reduced to stereotypes of their sex or have imposed upon them objectified fantasies of their sex so they are viewed as unworthy of equal citizenship or even inclusion in the idea of humanity. The purpose of specifically tailoring the degradation prohibition in this way is to lie ourselves with rather than pit ourselves against those who insist on the right to break out of the closet and to act up in public. On what basis did I and do I defend the imaginary domain and minimum conditions of individuation, and with them the degradation prohibition? I still think Lacan is helpful, but we could also get to the fragility of the human body and need for public support to it through other intellectual heritages, such as African philosophy, and as I suggested earlier, in a notion of trans individuality. And just a brief comment, which we can talk about in the discussion, Marxist feminism desperately needs a philosophical anthropology that completely challenges the some of the notions of the individual that have been assumed by it. And this is why the heritage of African socialism is so important to Marxist feminists. But how does one judge whether or not the imaginary domain is right? The answer is an aesthetic idea in Kant's sense. Famously, Kant argues that the great ideas of reason cannot be known, but only configured, and therefore the reflexive judgment on these ideals cannot have rules which tell us definitively what is right or wrong. The promise of the imaginary domain and minimum conditions of individuation was they could synchronize the values of freedom and equality in the emotionally fraught area of life we call sex and sexual beings. But it would also be equitable, as I've argued, to other forms of primary identification, such as language rights. Whether or not this synchronization has been achieved demands judgment as to whether justifying abortion in this way empowers women to give their own meaning to their abortions, to imagine their own bodies, and to represent their sex with joy within their difference. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.